Great to have you along here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at the world of insects with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, works out of the Insect Diagnostic Lab on the UW-Madison campus, and with a great website regarding insects as well, which we can talk about as we move along here today. But if you have a question about an insect that just maybe you're curious about, or maybe it's one that's troubling you, I hope you'll join us. The number 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And already several callers online, but Phil, welcome.
Nice to be here.
Yeah. What kinds of questions have you been getting in the office lately?
Ants and bed bugs. Carpenter ants are active, which we see quite commonly. And the dead giveaway is if you've got black ants in the house now, you know they're nesting indoors. Their interest is water, not so much food, but that will start to switch in about 4 or 5 weeks when they start to raise young. And I always tell people, we shouldn't have called them carpenter ants. I think that was a mistake because they don't eat wood, but they will nest in wood that has been water damaged. And so people sometimes misread that. So, and the bed bug thing just continues to be on a national level, a big issue because of the difficulty of control.
Let's go to the phones. Kevin in Sauk City, we'll start with you. Hi, Kevin. Thank you for calling.
Good morning, gentlemen. Thank you for taking my call. I have a two-prong issue that has been suggested to me as related, so I'd like to confirm that and see if you can recommend a cure. First off, I have a very healthy herd of voles that have pretty much taken over my yard over the last 2 to 3 years.
Voles?
And okay. I had them under control for a while, but they're back in full force. And second to that, I have, over the last 2 years, really bad last year, Japanese beetles that are defoliating both my birch and my ash tree. And I've noted when you go through the Sauk City, Prairie du Sac, and up to Baraboo area, you can see a lot of the damage from the Japanese beetles. I was able to kill them off a little bit late last year using a product called Seven and spraying it directly onto the foliage. But it's not very practical because you literally have to stand on your roof or have a tall enough ladder. You really can't reach the entire tree. And it's unfortunately after most of the damage has occurred. Now, it was suggested to me that the grubs that the moles are eating are, in fact, the larvae stage of that Japanese beetle. So, therefore, if I can attack the grubs, I've gotten a handle on both problems.
Yeah, it unfortunately isn't quite that simple. The first comment, ways of dealing with the Japanese beetle problems on the trees, there are some systemic chemicals that can be poured in the ground that the roots will uptake, and one treatment will get you through the season. The most common one we see is Bayer's tree and shrub insecticide, although there are some generic versions of that out there now, and you would typically put that on in May, early May, and that would protect the tree. Little interested on your comments on ash. I wonder if it's truly an ash because ash is not susceptible to Japanese beetle. Mountain ash would be, linden would be, birch definitely. The other thing, though, I always warn people about is although you may have some grub problems in your lawn, most of the time I find that the significant Japanese beetle problems are coming in from off property. They're flying in. They have a flight range of about a half a mile. And so it's too bad because that means you don't have control of the breeding source. And so the only way we justify treating lawns is if the lawn is suffering from grub damage. Now, I'm a little confused. At first, I thought you said voles, and then I thought you said moles.
Moles with the M as in Mary.
Okay. That one has a two-pronged part to it, too, is that although they do feed on grubs, they also feed on earthworms. And so we've had a lot of problems where people have not quite understood that, treated their lawn, killed all the grubs that are there, and they still have moles. And so the direction for treating those is either these harpoon traps or, there are some types of baits that can be used in their burrows, but it's kind of two different problems. So, unfortunately, there isn't an easy answer to either one of them, and it's definitely, as I said, the only reason I could justify you going through the bother of treating your lawn for grubs is if you had densities of about 10 per square foot. And then often what you will see are skunks and raccoons come in the lawns and tear them up to get after the grubs. That's one of the warning signs that we have excessive grub populations that may give you lawn problems. The other thing about Japanese beetle grubs is that lawns will tend to get in big-time trouble in September and October. It's a very late-season problem. And I've been always intrigued for all the Japanese beetle problems we've had, and they've been up in the Baraboo area now for about 7 or 8 years. We see relatively few home lawn problems compared to the large amount of ornamental plant damage we get. And as they said, that goes back to that they're flying in from somewhere else.
Hmm. And there's one way to deal with the moles that's been discussed on the show a few times, but I'll repeat it here because several people have said, hey, it really does work, and that is to get a rat trap and get a basket or large pail. Go to your lawn, find an active tunnel, put a hole in that tunnel, and then set your rat trap with some bacon grease. Put the basket over the top of the hole and the rat trap. And so you've got a dark spot there. And I know one guy was, one of the callers had said he had trapped 9.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh my goodness.
And usually there aren't that many. Usually there's just a couple making all that. But I think Scott Craven tried it too and had success. So it makes some sense if you have an active tunnel and you can open that hole up a little bit, they'll smell the bacon, come up to take a bite, and then of course with the rat trap under the basket, you're not no danger of the local cat stepping on it or something.
Well, I may try that. I've been using the spear traps, but time after time again, they prove they're smarter than I am.
Well, try that one out, Kevin. See if it works.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And Richard and Nina, on to you now. Hi, Richard.
Hi. Last fall, I was having some problems with the bees getting into my house. And I see where they're getting into the house. Unfortunately, it's behind a gutter, and I have to take the gutter down to get to the hole. So it wasn't too bad last fall, and I decided to just let it go till the weather gets cold. Well, the weather got cold, and of course it's covered with snow, but pretty soon the snow will be gone. So I'll have to actually confront the problem. What do you suggest? How do I?
Well, to be honest, more likely than not, you don't. What I'm suspicious of is it was not true bees, like honeybees. But
I'm not sure
been...
if it was. Actually, they looked even more like, almost like yellow jackets.
Yeah.
They weren't yellow jackets. They looked more like that.
Well, but usually what we have is a type of cavity nesting yellow jacket that gets in there. And the good news about them is that they die off and they do not come back to the same spot. So the colony's dead. The only thing that would be worth investigating is that opening of it, whatever it is, caulk, seal, screen. Just so it's not there, so that the small chance that a queen that comes out this spring finds the hole and starts things from scratch. But there's no allegiance to the nest. There's no way they overwinter in the nest. Now, the difference with honeybees is once in a while they will move into attics and the like. But if you had honeybees, if you went on a sunny 35-degree day and looked up there, they'd be active right now because honeybees do wake up in the winter under the right conditions. They kind of clean the hive out a little bit. So you'd see activity very early, whereas what's typical of these indoor nesting yellow jackets and wasps, and they're really paper wasps is what they are, is they start from scratch with a queen, build slowly, and usually they don't catch your attention until August and September where they might number 2,000 or 3,000 individuals. The colonies get pretty big, but then again, they just absolutely collapse by the time we get to about the 1st of November.
That makes sense, yeah. I won't be surprised if they were a paper wasps. I was looking for a nest on the exterior of the house, but they might go inside, huh?
Yeah, usually, and again, these are the same ones that would go in the ground because they would use an old rodent burrow. There are aerial nesters that are up in the trees and out in the open, and then there are these cavity nesters. They construct the same kind of nest. It's just where their preference is.
All right. There you go.
I'll just try plugging up the hole and see what happens.
All right. Good enough for you. And just thinking about it, if you do have honeybees, I think you've come across some situations where there was honey inside the cavity of walls.
It's a double problem. You know, we never talk about sealing bees off when they're active, whether it's honeybees or whatnot, because all that does is they'll find a way in and really give us a problem. For yellow jackets, typically the nest can be treated, and there's nothing to worry about other than
right.
that. With honeybees, if the bees were either somehow recycled, if you could get a local beekeeper to come and trap them, which is a good way of doing it, but often the beekeepers are just too busy or are concerned about disease issues and the like. But even if the bees are either recycled or killed, you also have to open up the wall because the honey could ferment. Cause problems. The honey could also attract wildlife. And lastly, if there's comb and honey left behind, if there's a swarm of bees anywhere in the neighborhood, they are attracted to that. So you draw the bees back in, so you get another colony. So it's both a carpenter's problem and a pest control person's problem when you get true honeybees in most cases.
Ross in Madison wonders if there are organic methods to control Japanese beetles from eating rose flowers.
Well, you know, pyrethrum, there are a handful of organic compounds that will affect Japanese beetle, but the dilemma is, like pyrethrin, which is derived from chrysanthemums, will break down in sunlight. So it will kill the Japanese beetles that are in front of you now, but by the afternoon, they can come back in. There is a product called spinosad, which is derived from a soil fungus. It isn't the best Japanese beetle product, but it will last a couple, 3 days. But as far as long-term solutions, you know, I can do it once or twice a summer and guarantee they won't get there. Unfortunately, there just isn't a product that works that way. And, you know, I've always told people, I mean, Japanese beetle is the most frustrating animal. If you don't have it in your yard, count your blessings. Once it shows up, it will take you to a whole new level of hating insects because the kind of damage it does, the diversity of plants, the difficulty in getting a good control, and even any control is seasonal because they're going to be right back at you again. And so, as I said, it takes the fun out of gardening for a lot of people.
Joe in Franklin, on to you now. Hi, Joe.
Hi.
Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
I have a question. A few summers ago, it was in the middle of summer, I found out on my deck, out on the patio, it's a brick patio, these two, they looked like caterpillars. They were about an inch and a quarter long, quarter inch in diameter, white. And the bodies seemed somewhat segmented, and on each segment there was a dot that glowed in the dark.
Okay.
Do you have any idea what they could be?
Yeah. To be honest, the old song, Glow Little Glowworm, referred to the larval stage of a glowworm beetle. And they glow in the dark. They're related to fireflies. But rather than the adults flashing, it's the larvae that make the light, and it doesn't flash. It tends to glow, and they're almost like a mood ring. If you disturb them over a period of a minute or so, the color will just go away. If you leave them be and they get happy again, they start to glow. In fact, what's going on here is the females are larva form. They never transform into the typical adult stage. So some of these glowworms you see are not just the larvae, they're adult females that are trying to draw a male in. And usually you see them in somewhat lush areas because they are predators in the immature stage on millipedes and in those kind of critters. Sometimes I'll get calls from people that, and they look under their shrubbery at night and there's six or seven of these things glowing, and it's kind of an eerie thing. And I would say they're somewhat uncommon. You know, you can go 4 or 5 years and not see them.
Yeah, I've never seen one before, and I haven't seen one since.
Yeah, so if you just did an internet search on glowworm, you could get a lot of pictures. To me, they're kind of a light tan color rather than... They look somewhat caterpillar-like, but tend to be a little bit skinnier, I think, than most of the caterpillars you see that are in that size range.
Well, that's interesting.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate the call. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest. Join in with your insect question or comment at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking insects today with Phil Pelletieri, Larry Mueller here. Let's turn to Sally in Wayland, Minnesota next. Sally, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hey, Larry. Thank you, Larry and Jim and Phil. Thank you for the program. I've been daydreaming about spring. Beautiful spring. I can't wait. But then my beautiful daydream was interrupted by my terrible nightmare, my nemesis, the Colorado potato beetle. And then my runner-up for nemesis is the cucumber beetle.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like, my question is two-part. I always try the organic solution to killing bugs. I always try that first, but invariably the beetles overcome, and then I have to bring out the big guns. So what is your recommendation for a good organic solution, and then if that fails, the appropriate chemical solution, please?
Well, for Colorado's, I think I've got one that will solve both, at least in the short run. The problem we've seen with that insect over the years is it does develop resistance But this spinosad product that I had mentioned to the previous caller on Japanese beetle, it will be sold under Dr. Jack's Dead Bug Juice. It's sold under the name Bullseye if you order it from Gardens Alive. It's also in Monterey's vegetable garden spray. And because it's derived from a soil fungus, it is organic, and it has very good activity against Colorado potato beetles. They are susceptible to it, and it's a product that's relatively new in the last 3 or 4 years for homeowners. Mm-hmm. It's also sold to larger-scale organic producers under the name Entrust. One of the interesting things is there are other formulations of this product, because of the way they are manufactured, are not organic. So it's called Conserve in the Greenhouse, same active ingredient, but it's not organic by organic standards. Unfortunately, the data that we've seen with this product against cucumber beetles, it isn't very good. It would be nice if it was broader spectrum. You can try it, but it just is kind of lukewarm, I think might be the way of putting it, which makes life a little more complicated for me, because then indeed you can try rotenone if you can find it. Although the interesting thing about that product, it's an old insecticide that's derived from the root of a plant that grows in South America. It's a good chewing insect killer. But to be honest, it's very toxic to fish, and there's even some concerns on human toxicity. And that's one of the things we always warn people about organic. It is a philosophy, but we always tell them, you know, each chemical you analyze, like you would analyze anything, they have their own personalities and problems. And natural and organic does not always mean that it's, quote, safe, that some of these products do have toxicity issues you have to pay attention to. But the thing that makes rotenone allowable in the backyard is that when you apply it, it breaks down in sunlight relatively quickly to a non-toxic form. So as long as you're not eating this stuff and following the label directions, that would be a reasonable choice. Then when you get to the synthetic sides, to be honest, I have more faith in the spinosad on Colorado potato beetle than the synthetic chemicals, because most of those are pyrethroids, and we've had some pyrethroid resistance. On the other hand, the pyrethroids, the ortho bug be gones and the, raid yard and garden type sprays, have some pretty good knockdown power on cucumber beetles. And the old standby is the insecticide 7, been around since the 50s. It's a good beetle and worm killer. It doesn't work against Colorados at all. They're totally resistant to it, but it does a pretty good job on cucumber beetles.
Excellent explanation. Thank you.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it, Sally. Vern in Appleton, we're on to you now. Hi, Vern.
Hello. Say, Phil, I've got a problem that I really am surprised at. I have wasps in my house now. Mm-hmm. I just killed two this morning.
Okay. Well, the explanation there is that we had talked about before that the colonies, basically, they starve out more than freezing out. But the way these things get through the winter is in the fall, they produce new queens, they become mated, and then they crawl under a rock or sometimes in people's attics to spend the winter. And then when you get warm days and those attics warm up, they already think it's spring. And so it's not unusual. In fact, where I get the most complaints for this is people are doing reconstruction. So they got a side of the house open and they're going to be insulating and whatnot. So there's lots of places for these things to crawl into, or old farmhouses that just have lots of nooks and crannies tend to have more of this overwintering problem. But the good news is the numbers have to be limited. And so, it really isn't, you kind of address the ones that are there, whether you get the vacuum cleaner out or the fly swatter, and just don't worry about things getting out of hand, because we're dealing with a very limited number. And I can assure you that there's no way, even if your attic is heated all winter long, the critters, true wasps, don't have any food storage. So they have to starve to death. There's no food to get outside, nothing. That's what makes honeybees so unique. It is the only bee or wasp that we have that spends the winter. But the reason they do that is that they have honey, which is their fuel source, stored in the colony. And that's what they utilize and metabolize to generate heat to allow them to get through. So honeybees are very unique. Everybody else pretty much shuts the door. But as I said, in your case, it sounds like a couple queens did find a way in your siding or whatnot. And now with a little bit of the warmer weather last week, they probably woke up.
Well, yep. I killed the first one in the middle of January in that bitter cold weather in my house. But I got another question concerning them. There is a nest between my window and my storm window in one of my windows. I didn't find it until late last fall. But would they be hatching out of there?
No, because, they even stop producing and raising young by the time we get towards the very end of August, because again, they just know that things are not going to be, food's not going to be available. So They came from somewhere else, and they could be associated with that same nest, but they tend to disperse. You know, the queens tend to fly off somewhere else.
Yeah.
In the like, and as I said, once in a while, I mean, the other comment, if people were to tell me this, I'd ask, well, are you bringing firewood in? Because honestly, a queen could have been in underneath the bark of a piece of firewood.
No, I'm not bringing firewood in.
Okay. Okay.
But I got another question. There was, this is the second year for that nest in the same place. Is that just a fluke, or do they...
Yeah, no, that's a fluke. They don't have any allegiance. In fact, we think the reason they don't is a way of preventing diseases spreading from one year to the next. If you go back to an old nest, there's a potential for disease there, so they seem to have evolved this idea of finding new sites. Now, if it's a good site, could a second queen come back and say, boy, this would be a great place to make a nest? Yes, and that's probably what happened. So what you need to look at is what was their access point around that window? There's got to be some kind of opening or cavity...
That I'm baffled at, because I don't know where they did. I tried to watch them when they leave,
mm-hmm.
but they seem to get in there and then they can't get out.
Okay, but they had to, in order to make a nest, they have to go out and chew up leaves and bring that stuff back. They also have to bring food, so they must have an access point, and that is sometimes difficult, although you did what I normally would suggest is just sit outside quietly and observe, although it could be that they could even be coming out from the overhang. You know, there's a way that they can weasel back and forth. But more often than not, they tend to prefer to have pretty close access to where the nest is located versus where they're coming and going. And, you know, we do have a new species of umbrella wasp that has moved into the state in the last 3 or 4 years. And one of its claims to fame is nesting in lots of kind of crazy, tight-fitting spaces. And so I have a wonder if you have one of these European paper wasps. They look like a yellow jacket, just a little bit longer and skinnier, but they're black and yellow in color, and I'm a little suspicious it would be one of those, because they seem to really like to nest around the house underneath shutters, those kind of things.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call, Vern. And more, here's another wasp question, I believe, from Michael in Milwaukee. Michael, hi.
Yes, hi. This is, I don't know if they're actually wasps. They could be wasps, hornets. It's a number of different wasp-like insects. I have a deck outside of my house that is made of a wood called ipe, which is incredibly hard wood. It actually doesn't burn, and it's supposed to be completely insect-resistant. It's raw wood, but it seems to attract wasps and hornets. Now, they're not eating it. They'll land on it, and they'll kind of, they look like they're chewing on it, but there's really nothing there, you know, there's nothing left behind after they're done, because this wood is incredibly hard. I've called the manufacturer of the wood, and they've never heard of this happening with their wood, and I'm wondering what it could be that they're doing and how I could stop them. It's raw wood, so it's not like they're eating any sort of a finish on the wood.
Well, see, you know, I'll get this complaint on cedar. As cedar weathers, and what happens there is the paper wasps come in, and they will chew. A little area off, and then they take it back and use it in making their nest. And so what you get is this old gray weathered wood and then these light tan spots where they've chewed. And I'm suspicious what they're trying to do is the same thing, but they're not successful because the wood is not weathered or is so hard they can't feed it through. But, you know, insects often don't learn.
It does weather and gray, like cedar wood.
Okay. Well, I wonder if that's what's drawing them in. And again, they're making an attempt, but because of the characteristics of the wood being so hard, it's not coming off. And so, unfortunately, the only thing I can think of, and this may take away from the effect that you want, is to seal it or paint it in some form. Yeah. On the other hand, you know, other than the nuisance of having them there, and what you tend to find with wasps is they really are only defensive when the nest is threatened. And so, even though, you know, people get concerned, I have a feeling that the opportunity to get stung is pretty low unless you, you know, unfortunately, yeah, put your hand down on one and the like. And as I said, I think they just have the mistaken idea that they would be capable of stripping off that upper surface.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Denny in Pewaukee, your turn. Hi, Denny.
Hi. I have a problem by my patio, by my back door. There's a dryer vent there, and right underneath the dryer vent, there's little pieces of insulation, and I think there's an insect trying to make a nest or whatever up in there. What kind of insect would that be?
Well, two thoughts come to mind. I mean, first, the non-insect thing is that they're mice, but if you're seeing that, I suspect you might have a carpenter ant colony up underneath there. And when carpenter ants make the the cavities they live in look like Swiss cheese. And when they make them bigger, whatever the substrate is, they push out. So I see styrofoam, I see wood chips, and potentially insulation. If it is insulation, what you always see with this, we call it frass as a term, is that there's little parts of insects and other things mixed with it. It's kind of like it's their garbage pile, and they're just pushing this stuff out. So if you observe it's not just straight insulation, but also has some other parts, it is carpet or ants. And so I would look in your sill plate area, in that area, for the ant activity. Just a couple squirts of Raid would take care of it. The big thing with carpet or ants is knowing where they are, and they're basically playing their cards for you. They're showing you exactly where they are. You may see the activity ebb and flow depending on cloudy days that are cold. The walls are probably too cold for them being active. But on warm days, and as we talked to, that's why I'm getting the calls now about black ants in the house. I know they're carpenter ants, and I know they're nesting there because there's no way we're going to see outside ant activity well until the end of April. And so that would be the most likely critter I could think of.
And if it's a dryer vent, that'd warm it up when you ran the dryer.
Yes, and so that probably would explain them being active even maybe in a little bit colder weather than you normally would think.
Okay, and then also in the fall in that same area, there seems to be a war of the ants every year. It seems like there's small ants that kind of live around the area, and then there's these flying ants that come in. And there's like a big war for a while, and then I get this insecticide, and I'll spray them, and then they'll all die.
Well, it's a little different. They're the same ant. It's just different forms of the same ant. You're seeing the kings and queens. Those are the big wing forms, and the small ones are the sterile females that we call workers. And certain species swarm at different times, and we have both field ants and cornfield ants swarm quite commonly in the fall. So you see this phenomena of just ants bubbling all over, and they're just kind of in a frenzy. And you come back 2 hours later, and they're gone, but you come back the next day in the afternoon, and they're there again. So the phenomena will often go on for about a week or so. And when you treat, you're killing the ants on the surface, but to be honest, the colony is still existing in the soil, I'm sure. If you're just surface treating, you're not getting it. The other side, though, is that either one of those two species of ants are not ants that typically come indoors and cause us any problems. And so, it's fine if you want to reduce the numbers because of the nuisance value. But I guess what I'm saying is if you leave them alone, it's not going to make any difference at all. And it would not be related to the ants that you're seeing in the house. The carpenter ants, when they swarm, the phenomena is typically in May and early June.
I see.
All right.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot for calling. Laurel in Greendale emailed us and said, I noticed black and white striped bees that come to my hummingbird feeders last summer. They seem to be quite aggressive, about as long as a yellow jacket, but fatter, definitely black and white striped. And my neighbor also has had huge round bee or hornet hives at the top of their maple trees, plainly in sight now. Not sure if these black and white bees would have come from that particular hive.
Yeah, I think so. It sounds like bald-faced hornet. And bald-faced hornet is a paper wasp, but it is more of a light whitish cream color on a black rather than the traditional yellow and black that we think of with German yellow jacket and Eastern yellow jacket and the like. There's a couple other species of vespid wasps that have that same black and white appearance, but definitely the most common one I see is the bald-faced hornet. It is somewhat bigger. Although they feed on protein to feed their young, general thing with wasps is they'll go to flowers to get nectar, and that's sugar water. It's kind of a quick energy drink for them. And so if they find a sugar source like you would have in a hummingbird feeder, it doesn't surprise me at all that they would try to forage on it. And then, of course, seeing the nest close by in a neighbor's would even make it verified, I think, even more. Hard to say if they'll be back from 1 year to the next. Their populations.
Die off.
Yes. Yes.
They do die off, so, okay. Jane and Vernon, on to you. Hi, Jane.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Well, I'd like to readdress the question that he talked about the Japanese beetles. First, about treating the ground. Last summer, I had large planters in front of my home that had cannas and some sweet potato vines, and they literally chewed those leaves. Do I need to treat that ground before I consider or think about replanting something there? And I have several neighbors that have containers that supposedly are to collect the Japanese beetles. Is that harming because they just it just brings them to that area,
sure,
to our area?
Well, first the traps. The research data tells us that you draw two to three times the number of beetles to your property than when you don't have the traps. So generally speaking, it makes matters worse rather than better. But there are certain circumstances, you know, if I've talked to people who had a large enough property that they could put the traps, you know, 200 yards away from the garden and draw them away. So there are certain circumstances that they do help alleviate things. But most of the time, it makes it worse rather than better.
Okay.
I stopped growing cannas. To be honest, it wasn't worth the fight. It is one of the more susceptible plants. The thing about cannas is the treatment that I was talking about, basically, as far as I'm aware, can only be used on woody trees and shrubs. It does
like
not...
My Rose of Sharon, I could put that on?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
It would be fine for that. But the label, I don't think, has herbaceous plants like cannas on there. And for that reason, you can't use it. And you can consult the label, but as I said, generally this stuff is used more for trees and shrubs. And then basically what I would tell you is when you put the cannas out and whatnot at planting, that's when it would be appropriate to put it on if the label would allow you to.
Okay.
The other option, again, is and this is where the frustration comes up with Japanese beetle, is there are a number of products at the Lawn and Garden Center that work, but they work for 4 or 5 days. And because the thing flies for 2 months plus, it becomes high maintenance. You're just out there fighting the game all the time. And that's just, you know, we don't want chemicals that last extended periods of time when they're exposed to sunlight and the like. And so they just, and those, that was the problem with DDT, is the thing just never broke down, which gets you into trouble. These chemicals that are used systemically, the difference is that the roots suck it up and maintain it in the plant sap. And that's where you get this extended 2 or 3 month worth of treatment. But as I said, they're typically not used for herbaceous plants. We use them in potatoes and a couple other crops and get some things, but the label is not as broad as it is for something like Ortho Bugbegone, which you can spray on almost anything.
Okay.
All right.
Now, do I need to consider treating the ground with some of this grub killer that I've read about? Because it supposedly do they not create grubs and then the grubs come up from the Japanese beetles?
Yeah, well, here's the cycle. Basically, they're laying their eggs in August, in July and August. The eggs hatch. They're little tiny white grubs. They look just like the grubs we all grew up with in the soil, but they're quite a bit smaller. And they feed in the late fall, and then in the spring they'll feed for a short period of time, and then they go through the transformation, and then the adults start flying about the 1st of July. So it's a one generation a year. And again, we had talked earlier that the problem is that most of us are suffering from beetles that are flying in from off our property. So you could kill all the grubs. There are some very good grub killers available. You could kill all the grubs in your lawn, and I don't think it's going to make any difference in the kind of injuries you see on your backyard plants. So the only time I would recommend treating your lawn for grubs is if the grubs are bad enough that your lawn is dying. They eat all the roots off it. And so the turf browns and gets droughty, like there's no water there. And even if you water it, it won't recover because there's no roots. You lift it up. And literally, when they get serious and you see 30 or 40 per square foot, you can lift up your sod like it's a piece of carpet because there's no roots holding it in. You see, those kind of things, you're treating for saving your lawn. That's the only reason that you would treat the lawn.
Okay.
Oh, thank you so much. You've been very helpful.
Thanks a lot for calling, Jane. And on to Phyllis in Cottage Grove. Hi, Phyllis.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I really enjoy your show.
Thank you.
I just have a quick question about what I tried to look up online and I couldn't find anything. And it's an ID of it looked exactly like a fly, a common house fly, only it was like at least 2 inches long. And though the antenna might have been a little different, but it was actually a very pretty fly, but it was humongous, and it was black, and I can't find it anywhere.
2 inches long, did you say?
Yeah,
huge. My first guess is look under black horsefly.
Okay.
You know, most horseflies are quite a bit smaller than that, but we have one species, Tabanus atrus, that is just huge.
Yeah.
And in fact, great big bulgy eyes, and the wings are almost a dark smoky brown. And that would be my first guess from that description, that it was a black horsefly. And they don't bite people.
Okay.
They're terrible on large livestock, as one can imagine, but
yeah,
they just don't seem to have an interest in biting people. And so that would be my best guess.
Last summer, and I have never seen it before, you know, and it was just very curious because it was actually very pretty, but it was huge. It looked like a mutant fly or something, you know.
Right, right.
So, all right. Well, I'll look that up. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for calling. Phil, is that a particular insect on your insect ID web page, you know, for sure?
I'm not 100% sure, probably, and it would be under big bugs. You know, when they put that ID section together, and I, you know, I always warn people, you know, we have about 20,000 species of insects, and I probably only have about, maybe 150 listed, but they're the more common ones. And I tried to put it in categories that people would identify: big bugs, you know, worms outside, worms inside. And yeah, I'm pretty sure I have a black horsefly there, because it is, again, you don't see a lot of them, but it's one of those, it's unique enough that usually it catches people's attention. And those are the kind of things that we try to point out to them. So
if you go to the entomology.wisc.edu.
Right. That would get you to our entomology department homepage. And if you go under outreach to the Insect Diagnostic Lab, mm-hmm. and then you'll have a menu that I have extension bulletins. I have an insect ID section. I also have a section that's kind of archived in past problems. Hit the insect ID section, you'll get another menu, and again, go under big bugs. And there'll be little thumbnails. You clip on the thumbnails, get a better image, and then usually we'll link you to some other information that we've got, other extension information.
Let's take a call from Maggie next in Blue River. Hi, Maggie.
Hi. I have a solution for anybody that's dealing with potato beetles.
Okay.
All you do is plant them later in the season, and you completely miss the insect outbreak. And it's just so nice because you don't have to think about it at all. You can plant after July 1st is what I was originally told by an integrated pest management person. And then I tried it on June 15th, and it worked just fine then, too. And you don't have to fight the insects at all by spreading anything out there.
Mm-hmm.
So it works really well.
Yeah, if you've got a potato that will mature in time. I mean, typically the way these things work in Wisconsin is that they overwinter as adults and literally come crawling into the garden. And in fact, one of the other strategies that is used sometimes is they call it trap cropping, is they will put a strip of potatoes right up close to kind of draw them in almost like a sponge, and then put their other planting later in somewhere else. That's another avenue. But if you've got the conditions that you can get the potatoes through, the later you plant, the less likely you are to get problems. Because if that first generation adults don't find you, you know, we get two waves of them under normal circumstances. If you miss that first wave, the second wave won't be coming.
Good.
I also got excellent crops, you know, totally nice mature potatoes, and I think it's, most people tell me when I suggest this, everybody's reaction is, oh, but I want those early new potatoes. But for me, it's so worth it to plant later and not have to worry about dealing with all those cute little babies that they have. Anyway, I just thought I'd tell you that.
Yeah, thank you so much.
You know, and it's interesting because watching in my career, you know, back in the 70s, if you were inclined to use chemicals, there were a lot of things that worked very well. Boy, by the 90s, the chemicals that you saw at the average garden store were worthless. I mean, this thing really does have a major resistance. And again, none of us like to get into high maintenance types of things for gardening. And so if you can come up with ways, you know, we did have some genetically modified potatoes that work quite well, but they've been taken off the home market, in fact, taken off the market completely because of, more politics than science, I think, but we won't get into that. So people are looking for things. As I said, it's interesting as we've got a couple newer products that do fit in the organic arena that are effective. But one gets nervous because of the past history of this is that 5 or 10 years from now, these products that are working quite well may not be working.
Yeah. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Phil, we have some emails in. I just want to mention one of those before we go back to the phones. Charles emailed us, says, I have property in Northeast Marquette County with hundreds of crabapple trees. During the past 3 to 4 springs, many of these trees have been infested with tent caterpillars. Last year I tried spraying with BT, but may have been too late. Is there a good time to spray if you're going to spray, and with what? It's more of a nuisance than anything else, just trying to keep some of them away from areas we tend to frequent.
Sure. Well, the BT is a good choice, but it's early is always better than late. And I can give you a couple options. I mean, right now, if you were to go and walk out and look at those trees, what you find is the egg masses of tent caterpillar are about 3/4 of an inch long. They're black and somewhat shiny and even a little foamy looking. And they will be around twigs about the diameter of your little finger to slightly smaller. And but usually because of that swelling, you can see them quite easily. And to be honest, if you cut, prune, scraped them off, every time you're doing that, you're taking a whole colony out. The other option is that knowing that those eggs are going to hatch about the time it starts to just break bud and leaf out, that is when, I mean, you need enough leaf tissue there that your BT sprays will go on.
Yeah.
That's the one problem with BT is if you've got big worms, it really isn't very effective. It's kind of half and smaller is where it would work. So whether you're using BT or other sprays, that would be the timing suggestion I make. The other option you've got is, you know, when the tents start, they're only about the size of a quarter. So again, if you watch very closely, you can see them, crush them very easily, and you're taking whole colonies out. Unfortunately, most people don't think about it until the worms are an inch long, and we're talking about something the size of a basketball or larger, and then it becomes much more difficult. So as I said, knowing that the timing is going to be exactly the same every year is when the buds start to open up and they start to growing, that's when they hatch. And when they hatch, they're only about 2 millimeters long. I mean, they're very tiny little worms, but of course, in the next 3 or 4 weeks, they grow up pretty quick.
Do the caterpillars affect fruit production on apples or and wild plums maybe?
Well, you know, it's amazing that the trees do very well in far as recovery. But the argument has always been is if the tree is forced to leaf out, it's burning energy to do that, which is going to affect fruit production down the road. So I think you do see some fruit loss. It's not night and day by any means. But as I said, it just makes common sense that if you're forcing the tree to refoliate, that's costing it some energy that it used to be able to put into producing fruit.
Ray in Manitowish Waters, we are on to you now. Hi, Ray.
Hello, gentlemen. Say, last year when I was futilely fishing for muskies, I noticed there was very little activity as far as mayfly hatch.
Ah.
Our water temperatures went up and down and up and down, and I know they affected the fishing. And I just wondered, if the mayflies didn't hatch, what does that mean for the coming year?
Well, it's, you know, what makes it a little complicated is, to an entomologist, mayfly could be about 60 different, there's 60 different kinds of mayflies in the state, at least. There may even be more. And I think you're right that if there were unusual environmental conditions, especially with water temperature, that can have a major effect because some of these things have a very narrow window of ideal conditions and anything that changes would affect it. The other side, though, that is interesting about insects is, boy, they recover very quickly. You know, and so my guess would be you're more likely than not. The law of averages would suggest that their populations would rebound quite quickly rather than this being a long-term type of effect. Unless, again, you continue to get these crazy water conditions. But as I said, that seems a little bit out of the norm. Last year, in general, I guess I've made this comment, you know, I'm out lecturing around the state right now, and this was probably as quiet an insect year as I have seen. And there's a lot of documentation of this. The corn borers are the lowest population we've seen in 42 years. Gypsy moth was down by 60% statewide when we talk about things. I mean, it's just even the butterflies weren't out. And so, you know, although I always tell people I hate to make predictions, I can't make any predictions about the winter weather often doesn't have. We haven't had the kind of extremes, the 35 belows that really would have an insect impact. But the law of averages would suggest we're going to see more insects because, as I said, last year was as quiet a year as I've seen in the 32 years I've been running the lab.
Yeah.
Will they come from other lakes? I mean, from warmer lakes? I live on the Manitowish Chain, which is a very deep lake.
Yeah.
They come over from other lakes?
Yeah, although, you know, mayflies tend to be relatively weak flyers, so they can't move as large a distances, but there are probably other little niches and environments that are holding populations. And so, as I said, I would think that there's some very close by areas that have residual populations that I would think would be able to rebound pretty quickly.
Well, thank you.
Thanks, Ray. How was your musky fishing last summer?
Oh, you don't want to know. Very poor.
Very poor. I tell you, thanks a lot, Ray. Appreciate it very much.
You bet.
Ray and I fished in the World Muskie Championship up in that neck of the woods a couple of years back, fished together. He's a very good muskie fisherman. So if he doesn't catch them,
it's a sign.
it's a bad sign. It's a bad sign. Oh, boy. Let's move on. Take some more calls here. Matt and Spooner, we'll turn to you next. Hi, Matt.
Hey, how you doing?
Great. Thank you for calling.
I got a question about a relationship with a fly and a I believe it's called a thread-waisted wasp. My daughter and I were observing what I learned was a thread-waisted wasp, and he was burying these little caterpillars in the sand. And he'd bring in his caterpillar, and he'd open up his little burrow, and then all of a sudden what would appear would be this tiny little blue iridescent fly. And it was aggravating the heck out of that wasp, and he'd never bury his caterpillar when these little flies were around. He'd chase them away or whatever. And when I went to look to see what kind of fly that was, I could find like hover flies and then maybe parasitic wasps, but nothing matched the color or the description of what he was trying to do there.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just wondering what that fly was after with the wasp's caterpillars.
Well, just taking a guess, but you know what the wasp is doing is burying the caterpillars. She'll lay her egg, and that caterpillar is the food store for the development of her grubs. And I would be highly suspicious that what this was is a parasitic fly of the grubs of the wasp.
Okay.
And the wasp knew this, you know, and his behavior was to either try to shoo it away or, you know, in some cases. Yeah, it's interesting that the family, and it's a big family, so you may have trouble. We call them the tachinids, T-A-C-H-N-I-I-D.
Okay.
And tachinid flies are all parasitic. There's a lot of them that are parasites on caterpillars even. And when you find a caterpillar, you see this little white elongated egg usually placed behind the head.
Okay.
The reason the fly puts it there is because if it put it farther back on the caterpillar, it would turn around and chew it off, but it can't reach it. What happens then is that egg hatches, the maggot develops and burrows into the caterpillar and kills it. So this is a very common, and as I said, there are literally, it wouldn't surprise me, well over 100 tachinids in the state. It's a big group. Most people just don't pay attention. Any fly is a house fly, you know, to them and the like. But this really sounds like that kind of behavior. The other thing I was thinking of is that it could be a cuckoo bee, which is a parasitic bee. But that would be bright iridescent, and it would look more bee-like. I think it would catch your attention that way. But they cause some similar things, that their grubs feed on the grubs of other bees. And so insects have some very interesting relationships. And as I said, I think that's what you're observing, is it was trying to fend off these parasites.
Okay, what you were talking about, the fly with the little white egg on it, when I excavated a couple of the burrows,
mm-hmm.
there would be like, some of them would have like six little caterpillars in there, and some of the caterpillars in the burrow would have a little white, and I thought that was from the wasp.
Well,
caterpillar, and some of them didn't have that.
Yeah, the wasp will lay her egg in that provision in burrow, but usually I don't think she's going to put it on the prey. And so I wonder if you had a double whammy going there, is that there was parasites. In fact, that's the interesting thing when you study these, is the parasites have their own parasites, and you find that what you thought was one insect can have six or seven different critters involved with it. And that's what affects the normal fluctuations of insect populations, is are all these natural parasites and predators. And as I said, it's always about 20 levels more complex than you would think it would be on the surface.
All right.
Yeah, you obviously got a lot of stuff to keep up on with these guys.
Yeah. Well, the thing among entomologists is anybody who thinks they understand it all, we know, has not read the right books, because, you know, there just is so much going on, and you just keep learning, and we have new things coming in. I mean, that's one of the things that's always been intriguing to me in running the lab, is every year I'm guaranteed to see a dozen things I've never seen before.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks, Matt. Right.
Thanks a lot.
Appreciate the call. Breanne in Barron, your turn. Hi, Breanne.
Hi. Just had a question. In the fall, we get what we call wireworms in the house, and they get into everything. Is there any way to prevent them from getting in the house?
Okay. What you've got are millipedes, not wireworms, but because when you walk on them, they crunch. That's where they often get that association. And what's going on is they are normal creatures that live in rich organic matter soil. And for some unknown reason, although what we speculate is they're looking for greener pastures, they often migrate around in fall evenings. So they're crawling around like crazy at night, and they like it damp and cool. And as soon as the sun comes up, they're looking for places to get out of the sun, which draws them into the house. And what you will find is they die. I mean, they don't breed indoors. They don't. But you can get this constant migration. And the location of your house has a lot to do with it. You can have the same house in the middle of the city, people never see it. But generally, if you're in an area that has a lot of prairies or old CRP ground or even sometimes cornfields that are no-tilled, so there's a lot of organic debris, those are the conditions that give us a lot of millipedes in the soil, and then they migrate. So two things to think about. One, if they're getting in easy, there may be something you can caulk and seal to physically prevent them from coming in. One of the treatments sometimes is to treat around your foundation of the house. And what I always warn people about with this particular creature is then the worms crawl through it. They come in your house and die. But that's just as bad as live ones. Yeah. And so what I usually try to get people to look at is how your property sits and where are they most likely coming from. I don't think they're coming from your lawn grass. But usually people have, you know, again, when these prairie areas on the north side of the property or they have a wood full of leaf litter that's 6 inches deep, I mean, that would be good conditions for them. And so when you treat, what we do is treat a band. And the closer you can put that band to where they're coming from, the quicker you'll stop them before they get to your house. So, or another example is people will often find these collecting on their garbage, or not their garbage, their cement slabs. So they treat the slab and that's not the source.
Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking insects with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, Larry Mueller here. Thank you for listening in, by the way. We've had questions about wireworms. You've had some comments about wireworms, Phil. I know there was maybe a thing or two that you'd like to add.
We're talking to the person that had the millipede problem, which is often called a wireworm. The true wireworm is basically a vegetable pest and comes out of grasses and it won't migrate in. And I guess the only thing I wanted to add to our earlier conversation is that this band or barrier that we put up, it can be a granular insecticide. It can be a spray. For this problem, I would do it about the first week of September because that's about the time we start to see the movement. And usually the band is 5 to 10 feet in width. And as I said, try to identify where they're coming from. And if you're not sure, you can go out there at night with a flashlight and look. But usually it's pretty obvious. As I said, it's not going to come from roadways. It's not going to come from mowed grass areas. It's going to be a place where you got a lot of thatch and organic matter and go after it from there.
Let's turn to Greg in Montchez. Hi, Greg. Oh, wait a second here. Greg, hold on. Here, now, as long as I pull up the right volume control, we can get you on. Hi, thank you for waiting.
I've been enjoying the show very much. I had a question about, I live in the country and have a lot of wasp, yellow jacket nests pretty much every year. And I have seen a sprayer used for spraying 7 powder made out of a real long quarter-inch galvanized pipe with an end of a bent copper piece on there with a brass fitting run by a compressor and sucking up 7 powder that... you know, it gives you some real reach in getting up into difficult places. And I could tell it was a fabricated kind of homemade device. It was, had a compressor, a compressed air hose attached to it with a compressor. And I've been looking around to try and find some kind of a design for one because I sure could use one around here. It's very hard for me to get the kind of reach I need to get some of the nests. And I wondered if there was any kind of a schematic anywhere at the extension or anything that I could use to, create a pattern for this.
Sure. Well, a couple thoughts. I mean, normally I suggest to folks that if the nests are really high up, you really ask, is it worth messing with them? Because usually those are, the ones that are most problematic, that are low, close to doors, where there's a chance of you disturbing them, and as we had talked about, that's when they get very aggressive. Now, another thought, an item that I have seen sold commercially, mostly to pest control people, because, you know, they're out doing these kind of things in large numbers, so they need them, is a similar type of thing. It's usually some type of piping that's usually can be broomed, you know, and expanded. But rather than going with the dust, and I love 7 dust for treating ground nests and other things, but it's so hard to apply dust up high. What these are basically on the top of it is they just put an aerosol can, and then they've got a device when you extend the pole that you can press something so the aerosol goes off and shoots when you can, so you can shoot it into the bottom of the nest. And to be honest, that's my recommendation for above ground nests that are out in the open is you use an aerosol because the products work much quicker. A quick knockdown, 3 or 4 seconds of squirting is enough. On the other hand, I love seven dust for things in there in the ground or in the walls because I find that the sprays don't work.
That's what I'm talking about, though, and that it is in the walls. And they do a lot of nesting in our cedar clad house and mm-hmm. then a studio building that we have. And, I mean, we've had them above our bedroom where we could hear the nest on mm-hmm. the other side of the drywall. I mean, we've had...
Sure.
You know, and that's what I'm talking about. And I like the dry powder, and boy, it was really effective getting it up there. But I don't know, I've been having trouble just getting. It was a real simple device, but I don't know, it'd be a real simple schematic. And boy, if I mm-hmm. can figure out how to make one, I'll put it on the internet. You know, because
sure,
yeah.
Well, the other thing to look at, although again, the question is how would you, you know, make it work? Is you know, typically what they'll use for these are called bulb dusters. And, you know, you put the 7 into a reservoir, and it has a little tiny straw on the end of it, and you almost work it like a bellows is one design where it comes up. So you wonder, too, about, you know, rather than having to have the compressor and suck it all the way up there, is if you could somehow put this at the end of a pole and then, again, work that bellows so that it's puffing the dust. And, you know, it's interesting because you don't often need a lot of dust. In fact, less is usually better than more. But the whole idea is to have it a way that you can pinpoint where you'd put it. So as I said, I wonder if you can look at the design of the bulb duster and see if there's some way you can put it on an extending pole and still get away of working the bellows to make
yeah,
it work.
That'd be worth a look. Think about that, and maybe somebody else has some ideas too, Greg.
So that would be a good idea. I'm wondering, though, so you, the answer to my question is no, there's
no.
The schematic.
No, I've never quite seen it. I know what you're doing. I can see what you're doing, but I've never seen anything quite that design.
Oh, yeah, I've seen them before, and even a guy who told me who used to do it, he said, oh, yeah, that's the kind of thing we use as our routine tool. And
yeah.
It
mm-hmm.
seemed really handy because of the reach mm-hmm. and the fact that it only took a second to get the nest. I mean,
yeah,
you turn on the compressor and it's done.
You know, you might consider doing a search under Do Your Own Pest Control because there are three or four companies on the Internet that sell the kind of products that pest control companies use. Over the counter. I mean, there's no reason why you can't. And so they often have a lot of these tools that you wouldn't find at the normal hardware store. And so that, again, may be a way of, if indeed he had found something that was made commercially, that would be the most likely place I could think of having it.
All right. There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
We've got an email from Jim in Black River Falls, just curious about what insects have been exported to other countries from the U.S. that have caused them troubles.
Well, you know, the one that comes to mind is the Colorado potato beetle in Europe.
Oh.
You know, it has been a major problem for them, and it is indigenous to the Rocky Mountains originally in South America and the like. So that was definitely a North American critter that got in a place it didn't belong. I know there are some bark beetles. You know, there's been a problem for all of us worldwide of species of bark beetles and their relatives being brought back and forth. But as I said, that's the one that as soon
really?
As you asked the question, that it just jumped out at me because I know in Germany and elsewhere, you know, life was very good before that thing showed up.
Mark in Onalaska, we're on to you now. Hi, Mark.
Hi. Say, last summer, late spring, it was end of May, early June, I had what appeared to be infestations of June bugs in my yard that would appear at nighttime at dusk, and they defoliated my birch and oak trees, young trees, quite a bit, and as well as I noticed them in adjoining yards. Now, looking forward to 2010, is there anything I can do to perhaps prevent a similar occurrence this spring?
Well, I think there's two things to be concerned about. All the June beetle species we have in Wisconsin have a 2, and most of them a 3-year life cycle. And so we don't see these intense populations annually. They go in cycles. So I'm guessing the most likely time you're going to have this kind of pressure again is 3 years from the date of the first one. But the other concern is that when we get these high adult populations, they lay eggs, and it's the next year that we see the lawn damage. And so I think something that you're going to have to watch this year is to see if you have heavy grub populations in your lawns that may have to be addressed or the lawns will suffer. So, again, it's kind of this relationship. You don't have the lawn problem if the adults don't show up the year before. You definitely had one of those big adult years. But I have not seen, and as I said, the cycles, just the way they work historically, is they go on these 3-year waves. And sometimes the adults peter out. It's interesting that this pattern was really very well-defined from the 40s all the way into the 80s. And then we had that crazy drought in 88 and 89. And honestly, the cycle's gotten a little wacky because I have not seen these big adult populations in most of the southern part of the state, but they seem to be pretty consistent up in Washira County and some of the places in kind of the central east side of the state. And as I said, these patterns then, that they're folding back into it. And we just think that, again, the drought was so severe that it caused these insects to kind of get a little bit out of whack. But so I think it's less likely that you're going to have the ornamental damage, but I think it is quite likely you might have lawn issues this year.
Okay, is there anything I should be doing proactively before I see the lawn damage, or
the lawn probably isn't going to show you any activity until you get well into June. What would be worth the effort is to get out there and peel back some sod and just get some idea of grub numbers.
Okay.
I would tell you if the densities are below a couple, 3 per square foot, that's not enough to cause you concern. If it's above that, there are various products that can be applied that will kill the grubs. And what will happen, too, is if you ignore this, the lawn may do reasonably well.
Uh-huh.
But these are the kind of scenarios that in the fall of the year I get the skunk and raccoon damage because the grub population, they've grown all summer. They're big and plush. The skunks find it. And that does more damage than the grubs ever could. Have you ever seen what a skunk can do? It just is like a rotor tiller in there.
Yeah.
And so, as I said, I think as long as you somehow mark, let's take a look at the lawn, see if they're there. If it is, shut the door in June. And then you won't have that problem. And if they're not there, the skunks won't be there. The lawn won't suffer, so it won't be. But it, as I said, it's just such a common relationship that it definitely bears taking a peek at it.
Good luck. Thanks, Mark, for calling. Appreciate it. Sue in Appleton, we're on to you now. Hi, Sue.
Hi. I have a question about a spider. I draw water for my plant collection in tubs and let it stand overnight. And ever so often when I come back to the tubs, I'll find a spiders sprawled on the surface of the water, and I'm wondering what's going on here. They're alive, and they're just floating on the top of the water, and sometimes they'll be there for a couple of days.
Big spider or little spider?
About an inch across.
Well, you know, there's a group of spiders that are called raft spiders that are related to wolf spiders, really, but they tend to get pretty big, and they honestly will live next to lakes and the like, and the way their legs are structured, they almost can walk on water, you know.
Yeah,
they don't break the surface tension. And so I wonder if it's a form of that, although, as I said, most of the species I'm familiar with are bigger than that. But, you know, most spiders that don't have that capacity would avoid that because they could potentially drown. So, as I said, I wonder if it's out of that group. I don't know if there's some Agalina grass spiders that might be able to do that also, but as I said, the raft spiders are the ones that I would at least take the first peek at.
Uh-huh. The tubs are in my basement.
Okay.
And I just wondered how they, you know, how they could float around on there without, they don't die. They're in there for quite a long time.
Well, usually, you know, things that do this have special little hairs on the tips, and it basically, you know, spreads out the surface tension and such so that again, that they don't walk per se, but they float real well, might be a better way of putting it. So.
Mm-hmm. There you have it.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Sue. And Matthew in Richland Center, your turn. Hi.
Oh, yes. I was just wondering if there's any way to keep earwigs out of the house.
I have a solution, but people don't like it when I tell them. I said if I make your backyard a sandbox, it would be a habitat there would be no earwigs in. The thing to look at is earwigs are a lot like that story of these millipedes that we had. They really don't come in on purpose. But earwigs are out cruising around at night, and they feed on plant material. They also feed on other insects. But when we find that the sun comes up, they're looking for some place that's cool, damp, and dark, and that's when they scurry. And so, you know, so you look at your door sweeps to make sure that they fit well. But what I find is a classic weakness when we build homes is where your siding meets the foundation. It may be tight enough that energy doesn't really escape to a big degree. But things can often crawl up underneath there and then weasel their way through and show up into the house. And so we find that by going through and getting an expanding caulk or some other material and tighten that up, that will help. The other thing that will help is along the foundation, really the drier you can make it, the better. You know. And so a lot of us like to put plants there because it looks nice. But the lusher you make it, the more attractive it is to earwigs because that's what they're looking for, is shade, coolness, dampness. And so hostas, which are classically planted along the foundation, are earwig heaven. So sometimes physically adjusting what you plant will help. But in the long run, the whole idea of tightening things up correctly will make the biggest difference. If they get indoors, the good news is they can't breed indoors. There's nothing to eat. You'll see they'll often congregate where it's cool and damp. In fact, a classic place to find them is underneath the bathroom towel that the kids forgot on the bathroom floor. It's damp. They'll crawl underneath there, and of course, then you pick it up. They just go scurrying, and nobody's happy about that. But I would look at the physical adjustments to the landscape and tightening up the house, and that will make the biggest difference.
Thank you very much for calling. Elizabeth in Columbus emailed us. I live on 9 acres north of Madison, Columbia County, pretty much ag country. In the center of the property, we have an American elm, 30 to 40 feet tall at least. It looks pretty poor with 30 to 50% of the leaf eaten early in the season. Last year, I watered and fertilized it adequately, but it still looked the same. After a lot of inspection, I find a significant amount of elm flea weevil on the leaves. I did a little investigation on the internet. Sounds like it's a newer pest in the area, not considered overly problematic, typically. Found no suggestions about treatment. My question, with 30 to 50% of leaf damage, should I worry about treating the pest or just continue supportive care? Any suggestions?
Okay. 30 to 50%, to be honest, I don't expect to affect the health of the tree. Elms are really pretty resilient. Elms and willows take an awful lot of defoliation. I wonder, though, if this is truly an American elm, because elm flea weevil tends to like things that have Siberian or Chinese genetics in it. So Chinese elm or some of the new hybrids that are mixers of those are susceptible. But we tend to not see it in pure North American American elm. If it was a small tree, there are systemics that you could put on. The problem with the big tree is it would be very expensive to do. It would keep the leaves on, but again, ultimately, as far as the health of the tree, it's not going to matter. So I would classify that damage, even though they look pretty shabby, as cosmetic. The other thing that I'm hopeful for, you know, we've only had experience with this critter for about 6 or 7 years in the state, and it's moved out of the southeast, but it seems to settle down over time. And so I'm wondering if you're kind of on the new wave of it, and it might be bad for a couple, 3 years, but it will lessen in time. At least that's my hope, and it's a bit of the pattern I've seen so far. So, I normally would not recommend bothering with the cosmetic thing. I think the tree will do just fine.
Brad in Fountain City. Or I'm sorry, Brad in Fountain, Minnesota. Let's go there. Hi, Brad.
Hi. See, I just got a question. During the summer when I go out and I move my cows, I've noticed on the manure patties there's some like a gold-colored fly or possibly a bee, and I've never quite figured out what they are, and I just wonder if they're in there after the moisture. This is on fresh manure, and then if you walk back by in a day or two when the patties kind of dry out, I've noticed little holes, and I've always kind of wondered if that wasn't maybe a dung beetle or something doing that, or maybe these flies or a bee or whatever they are. We're laying eggs or something, and I was just wondering if you kind of give me an idea what they might be.
Well, I think you're right on both accounts. I think a lot of the little holes you see are from various dung beetles. There is a family of flies called anthomyiid flies, and we often will call them, some of the species, dung flies, because you commonly see them associated with high organic matter and waste. They tend to be not near as aggressive as house flies, you know, which tend to be like a little bit fresher, a little bit more liquid waste. These things will get after stuff that's a little bit drier and help recycle it. But, you know, the neat thing, people probably don't want to think of this, but in a manure paddy, there is just a whole zoo of things going on. And even in the dung beetle group, you know, it isn't unusual to find a dozen or more species associated with a cow paddy as it ages. And so, yeah, these bright golden anthomyiid flies, I know that's what it is, and I suspect they are breeding in the pads.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And we have some more calls here. Let's go to Jack in Milwaukee. Hi, Jack. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I've got a question about all these wasps and black-faced or white-faced wasps. We have grapes, and the wasps are a real problem when it comes to picking in the fall.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering, is there any way to control the population either earlier in the year or some way to put poison on individual wasps or whatnot to let them take it back to the hive and kill a hive from within?
Well,
rather than just, wantonly spraying seven because even if you spray seven, it only, you know, lifespan is like 3.5 days, but you can't pick for seven.
Sure.
And then what happens is in the meantime, they come right back again, you know.
Yeah, and people have looked at, in fact, this of solving baiting for wasps. It's the ideal way to kill them, and nobody has come up with a real good bait. You know, in the wasp traps that are sold, I always tell people, I mean, you can catch a lot of wasps, but it's a competition thing. I mean, what would they like to go after, more of your nice grapes or this can of Mountain Dew that's sitting in this wasp trap? So they help reduce the numbers, but they don't solve it very well. And some of the species, like the bald-faced hornets, they just don't seem to have a lot of interest in the kind of food baits that we have in the wasp trap. So it's not an easy answer. One of the things that works sometimes, but I don't know if you've got the time or have the interest, a colleague who is the pest control officer here at the university has trouble with yellow jackets around Camp Randall in the start of the football season, because the yellow jackets like the pop that everybody's drinking. And what Doug does is he'll take a dish of sweet stuff, and again, Mountain Dew pop or the like, and he'll put it out and he'll let the wasp come and feed on it. And then what he does is he trails them to try to find out where's the source of the nest, with the idea that if you catch one in the trap, you only kill one. If you find where the nest is, you're taking out a few hundred at a time. And so his investment in time here, and some of these are going to be ground nests that are on your property. Some of them are going to be nests that are in a shrub that you didn't see. So for his efficiency, I find that probably is as good as it could be. Back when I was a student, my major professor was playing around with boric acid diluted into a sweet syrup for killing wasps and bees. And it worked somewhat. But one of the problems is you get a lot of non-targets that come into it. So you get a lot of beneficial bees and whatnot that also feed on the nectar of flowers that are attracted to this. And if they ingest it, so that's why that's never been developed, is you just can't target the pest species without affecting things that you don't want to kill. So unfortunately, I don't have an easy answer. You know, the other thing that people will do is sometimes use these floating row covers and physically keep the wasps away. I will tell you that it does help. The more overly ripe and damaged fruit that you have in the area, the more critters you draw in. So sometimes a bit of a sanitation for some of this stuff will help a little bit, because the wasps just don't find the high sugars they're after, and they'll find someplace else to get their food. But it is problematic in some years, worse than others. Last year, I will tell you, was a somewhat quiet wasp year. It was cool. That tends to slow their development, but that doesn't mean there still wasn't some out there.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Phil, are you going to be at the Wisconsin Public Television Garden Expo this year?
Yes, I will be there for sure on Saturday and Sunday, and I have a colleague that will be there. There will be an entomologist there all the time that the show is open, definitely.
And I'll be there. Bob Tomish and I are going to do a little sort of takeoff on our Garden Talk program, and so we've got 10 o'clock on Saturday on the 13th. Bob and I will be in I'm not sure which meeting room, but one of the meeting rooms, and we'll be answering questions from anybody who shows up. We've got some little prizes to hand out, and a few little gifts to hand out too. So it's always a lot of fun, isn't it, that Garden Expo?
Yeah, real busy day. I'll be talking on Sunday at noon on the top insect problems of this past year and stuff. But it's just kind of fun to see people. And I already know that Japanese beetle is going to be the number one question, unfortunately. As we talked about, I wish I had better solutions. But some of it is, I think, just educating people on the facts of life.
Well, we'll be talking some more about the Garden Expo probably tomorrow, because coming up tomorrow is another edition of Garden Talk, and Shelley Ryan will be my guest. And, of course, Shelley plays a mighty big role in the whole Garden Expo. She's there practically around the clock, I swear. And so we'll be talking with her about garden things, and we'll also be talking a little bit about the Garden Expo as well. In the meantime, thanks, Phil. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest. And thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.